Thank you all so much for joining us. We are going through our series for the year, Garden to Garden, where by the end of the year, we will have gone through the entire arc of the Bible and we'll have read through it together as a community, or at least we will have tried to. And so it's March, and we have made it so far all the way to the second book of the Bible. It's a great, great pace. The pace is intentional. We're doing well. This is actually going to be a nice complementary continuation of what Kevin talked about last week, introducing us to the Exodus narrative. So we met Moses, and we left off where we'll be picking up the story today, which is a full-grown Moses is now called by God to confront Pharaoh and ask Pharaoh to let Israel out of the oppressive slavery that Pharaoh has Israel under. So the way, the way this part of the narrative begins, it begins with a very clear delineation of what the ask is. It says, "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Now you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh. Indeed, by a mighty hand, he will let Israel go. By a mighty hand, he will drive them out of this land.'" So that's the text that we're going to cover today. Several chapters is literally this unfolding and everything it takes for this to happen. And the main way through which God shows to Pharaoh who's in charge and what Pharaoh ought to do is through the series of 10 plagues that the land experiences. And this is actually quite dramatic, right? I think if you think about stories in the Old Testament, this one is probably one of the ones that gets the most, imagination and coverage and discussion in shows and movies. Probably, many of you are familiar with or have actually seen, various renditions of these stories over time. Probably like every decade, there's a new, talent that will take on doing these stories. Of course, making sure the consistent theme across all of them is Moses got to have those prominent cheekbones. That's what it really takes to deliver the message of the Lord. The 10 plagues themselves are ones that, you may have like some familiarity with, or maybe like you think you've got like the general idea of what those plagues are. So we're putting them up there. These are the ones that, we'll cover, like you should have in mind as we go through the text. I think what is interesting is probably most of us have a general idea of the plagues, but maybe they run together to you after a while. Because a case in point, if you didn't notice, a couple of those are actually not the plagues that are mentioned in Egypt itself. They occur in other places in the Bible. There's no shortage of plagues to talk about that occur in the Bible story. But those are actually, it's boils and hail. So those are like the 10 plagues as they occur in the text. Perhaps you didn't notice that attention to detail because you were still distracted by Moses' cheekbones from earlier. There's a lot to handle in this story. What's interesting too is a couple things to call out that actually progress as the subsequent plagues happen that I thought are pretty interesting. And one of them, the last one, we actually will revisit in more detail because of how consequential it is to the broader point that we'll talk through today. But what's one of the interesting things is when these plagues first start happening, Pharaoh and his court have a hard posture of disbelief and opposition to Moses. And one of the things that Pharaoh's court does is they replicate some of the miracles or like magic, the way that they were thinking about it. They replicate some of that perceived sorcery that is going on, which can be shocking, to like us when we read the text being like, oh, so God's opponents can do some of that stuff too. What is interesting is that as the plagues escalate, as you progress through them, Pharaoh's sorcerers are less able to do those things. So at some point, they reach their inability to replicate what's going on, and they're out of their depth. Another progressive dimension, too, is as the plagues progress, Israel gets increasingly like explicitly separated from the like the damage that the plagues will do to the community, so that like by the time you get to the end, for those last couple of plagues, for example, Israel in the part of Egypt that they're in, Goshen, they don't experience darkness, for example, and they don't experience the death of their firstborn sons, provided that they observe the Passover, which we'll talk about as well. So this is a, like it's an interesting, you know, development there. The other thing, too, is Pharaoh bargains with Moses throughout, like as these plagues progress. And the what Pharaoh is willing to concede becomes greater and greater as the plagues progress as well. And that's the one we'll actually talk through a little bit later. But in the spirit of garden to garden, I think it's helpful to acknowledge some of the many firsts in the whole biblical narrative that occur just within this span of text, in this story of Moses leading Israel out of oppression in Egypt. So this is actually the first big strong man. You know, I mean, I put that in capital letters, meaning the like an archetypical figure of a big strong man who opposes God's will. This is the first time someone like that appears in the biblical narrative. And the way that Exodus talks about the stakes is they are very much like the stakes that we're all very familiar with for like other kings or leaders that occur in the Bible who, for example, are direct opponents of Jesus or some of the prophets. So the Exodus narrative sets the stage where God says, "On all the gods of Egypt, I will execute judgments. I am the Lord." So meaning like these Pharaoh is basically like a big strong man representative, like a stand-in for the divine powers of Egypt. And God is framing this whole thing as like, this is not just a battle between Moses and Pharaoh or Israel and Egypt. This is a battle between the God of Israel and the gods of Egypt, the way that the story construes them. And so, you know, in literature, and like Kevin talked about last week, I think it's, you know, culturally, I think it's very easy for us to picture this story as, you know, a clash between like, you know, a big strong man or two big strong men, right? So this is the Ridley Scott version of Exodus that came out like a decade ago. And then, you know, you can see, look at these, like these two strides, Moses on the right, Pharaoh on the left, two very strong men staring at each other's, I'm assuming, cheekbones and holding their swords, ready to face off, right? This is kind of how we construe this. And we lean into this idea that this battle is between like who is going to be tougher between the two. Like that is the showdown. And, you know, what is, I think what can be like very tough is like all the ways that we like just in our own minds of like how we imagine like God opposing the powers in the world, we like lean into and perpetuate these kinds of stereotypes about how masculinity works and how the people that people of God that God works through. Even just a 2,000 years later or so, there's a clash of powers that happened in Gladiator 2, and it's not a coincidence that the way, like, so the villains of the movie are on the left, and they are, it's, again, this is not my choice, this is not a coincidence that they are portrayed in very weak and effeminate characterization. And the movie puts them up against, look at those zaddies, like this, they epitomize masculinity. And this is like, you know, how you're supposed to think about that that battle. This is, you know, as much as you can say like, oh, that's like, you know, that's so funny for them, I'm not like that. I know who God like actually works through. I would say like, I'm not sure. I think we all buy into wanting that big strong man to fight our battles for us in some way at some times, whether we're willing to admit it or not. A classic example of how even Israel, you know, falls into this trope is when Israel is transitioning into a monarchic era. So when they're, you know, entering a monarchy, there's this There's this subtext where they want their big strong man, like all of the other regions around them have their own big strong men, and so they advocate for Saul, who's very handsome, very tall, very masculine, seen here contemplating how he can make his cheekbones more prominent, right? Like this is exactly how like we think of this in artwork. And I think what the fact that when the text in the Old Testament talks about Saul this way, it actually underscores that even though it is true, like in the Bible, there are many confrontations between God's people and big, strong men, you get a clear idea that God or the writers of the Bible don't actually buy into that whole trope as like the way that God will accomplish God's goals. So there are several, right? Like you could probably, if you've ever like perused the Bible or you've read parts of it over time, there are so many kings. And I think one of these kings, Caesars, governors, rulers, even over Jesus's lifetime, they encountered several. And one of the things that a text like Exodus and all of these other texts that we're talking about, what they invite you to do is to ask, in what ways is God actually showing us the ridiculousness of relying on that big strong man, that Pharaoh, to be the one through whom God can accomplish God's goals? And so we'll see some of the many ways that clearly that trope or that way of being for Pharaoh becomes ultimately very self-destructive, and God is able to help Israel persevere because of the tragic, brutal weaknesses that are in that type of attitude. So there's a couple other firsts that I think would be valuable just to anchor on for the rest of the garden to garden that we'll go through. This is the first time in our text so far that we get this idea, the word used for redeem or redemption, like the way we often talk about it in Christianese when we talk about like what Jesus did for us. So here it shows up in Exodus 6. It says, "Say therefore to the Israelites, I am the Lord, and I will free you from the burdens of the Egyptians and deliver you from slavery to them. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great acts of judgment." So this is the first time, right? Well, again, the way we normally encounter that word, we think about Jesus and his sacrifice and how it results in our forgiveness of sins. And here it comes up in its purest core, which is literally to free Israel from the slavery that they're in. Salvation is also, this is the first time this word shows up in our text. Now again, like bedrock ideas that followers of Jesus latch onto. So here in Exodus 14, it says, "But Moses said to the people, 'Do not be afraid, stand firm and see the salvation that the Lord will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see, you shall never see again.'" Another verse that's significant is this is where the first Passover shows up in our text. And here, this is before the 10th plague, as Israel is preparing for it. They follow what God asked them to do, and so they're able to avoid the devastating consequences of that final plague. And so this is how the text talks about it. It says, it is the Passover sacrifice to the Lord, for he has passed over the houses of the Israelites in Egypt when he struck down the Egyptians but spared our houses." So that was when the God of Israel spared the firstborn sons of Israel's households but did not do that for Egyptian households. So again, it's interesting, right? You have redemption, salvation, even Passover. And if you think about the way that followers of Jesus carry on the tradition of Passover and layer new meaning onto it through communion, many of those things, I think, we just tend to think about as very spiritual terms, right? Forgiveness of sins, salvation from, presumably going to hell, or just like salvation from my sinfulness. We often think of communion as a time, like a, personal time to reflect on Jesus. And yet here we see these phrases come up in such deeply visceral terms. For God's people, salvation, redemption, forgiveness, Passover, they're not abstract concepts. They're not just spiritual concepts. They are like holistic ways of being that people feel. It's why when Jesus goes around healing people from their illnesses, he says, "You are forgiven. Your faith has saved you." Right? So this is like for followers of Jesus, they really we need to like ground ourselves in the very very visceral way that they they experience this this being freed from the evil forces that oversee them. We also get in this text, which I think is really fun, is our first worship leader. So this is the first time in, worship leader in the sense that you have like one person, gathering a group of people and worshiping together and leading them in it. And that first worship leader is, does anyone remember? Yeah, it's Miriam. So it goes, so this is after they are rescued, right? So, and then, Pharaoh and his army, they're destroyed as they're trying to pursue Israel. So this is what Miriam sings. So it says, "Then the prophet Miriam, Aaron's sister, took a tambourine in her hand, and all the women went out after her with tambourines and with dancing. And Miriam sang to them, 'Sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. Horse and rider he has thrown into the sea.'" What I love about this first worship song that this first worship leader leads is it is about the violent overthrow of God's enemies. It's not like, oh, let's be thankful like God has done so much for us. No, it's like, let's be thankful Pharaoh is destroyed, right? Like, that's the idea. Let's celebrate. Even their horses are dead, right? Like, that's the kind of freedom that they're celebrating here. This is like, this is also like the psychological concept called Schadenfreude, if you know that. It's like the feeling that you get when you are celebrating a bad thing, like you feel good about a bad thing happening to someone else. This is the OG worship song. Like, this is how it is. And I think particularly interesting that I think that kind of like gloating over your enemy can be stereotypically very masculine. So I love it all the more that it's a woman who's like is leading this song. Just goes to show all the different ways that you can celebrate what God does for God's people. But I do think that like this raw, unsanitized, visceral description of celebration is helpful to latch onto because you probably, my guess is, you don't sing songs like that when you thank God for what God has done. And I think it's worth asking why, because this is not the only song in the Bible that's like this. This is very tame compared to some of the most aggressive celebrations of what God does to God's enemies. And I think we'll need to come back to this. Like, okay, how should we think through this attitude and the what we might see in practice today among followers of Jesus? So those are, I think, some good firsts to ground ourselves in the discussion. I think one of the key themes that we can talk through that occur in this text, it actually has to do kind of with this violence that God puts on Egypt in the process, where the arc of the story for Moses from beginning to end is to have faith in God because Moses knows that ultimately resisting God is futile. Like, it is not going to, for Pharaoh, accomplish any good thing that Pharaoh wants to accomplish. Now, I think that for a lot of us, thousands of years removed from these kinds of events, in a place of relative safety, and in a very modern world, we might actually look at some of the things that God does in this story and actually think, like, ugh, doesn't that seem like really violent and like unnecessarily brutal? And doesn't it make God seem also kind of like a villain in this story with the things that God is doing? And this is like a common question that comes up, like, when we like think about our characterization of like, what does it mean for God to love, to be loving and to make the world right? And how does, this idea of the fact that it takes a lot of violence and a lot of destruction and a lot of death, including presumably the like loss of Egyptian innocent people's lives, who, you know, they weren't supporters of the Pharaoh's empire, right? Like they people, there's a lot of collateral damage to get God's people free. And it actually raises, I think, like good questions in discussions about like what should we think about God's character as revealed in stories like this. In the world of apologetics, I think one of the unsatisfying approaches towards answering those questions happens in books like this. Like this is a book, I think, you know, 10, 20 years ago at this point, that kind of like tries to take this approach of basically what I would say is like trying to minimize how violent or presumably evil the things that God does are in these stories. So, for example, like within this bucket of argumentation, you know, sometimes people will say like, oh, well, you know, they exaggerate the Bible exaggerates like the numbers of like armies, the populations of people involved. So not as many people died as the text seems to say that it does. This is one, like, you know, an argument that gets made. Another one, too, is like in this story, Israel is being freed from slavery, but, you know, in when the law is given in a few chapters and books, Israel will have slavery within it, right? There'll be, we'll get to that when we get there, but it raises questions, right? Like, well, hold on, I thought from this text, God was like clearly against slavery, and then it seems to, the Torah seems to have all kinds of laws that like protect and reinforce slavery. And so some people, again, they will take this kind of approach and be like, right, but slavery back then, it wasn't as bad. And the way Israel did it, it wasn't as bad as the, you know, the way you're imagining it today or the way that America has done it and so on and so forth. So you get the idea, right? It's minimal, like that's the whole goal. Another example that comes up is people have, even scholars have had debates about like, well, could the 10 plagues that you know, happened over Egypt, could they actually have been like natural disasters with natural explanation? So God wasn't the one like actually, you know, turning the Nile River into blood. It happened. And then the frogs raining was like a domino effect, like a physiological domino effect of that. And then the gnats and like ecological disasters in sequence. And like, I mean, some scholars have like meaningful debates back and forth about like, okay, what could have been the natural series of events that would have caused it to happen? It's like, maybe the Nile appeared to be like blood because of a red chemical that would have, you know, blah, blah, blah. Like that's how those discussions go. And again, I follow those discussions and I'm like, I don't know, at the end of the day, the text is actually saying like God wanted these things to happen, and it seems like God like wanted that type of destruction so that Pharaoh could learn his lesson, so that he would relent and free Israel. And so what I have come instead to appreciate much more, that I think is actually even much more fun too when you actually like read through the arc of the Bible, is to see the different threads and different voices that bear on this question of, you know, what is God's attitude towards evil or using evil to accomplish God's will? Like, what does God's wrath actually look like? And what I would argue is that what you can see actually, like, over the course of the Bible itself is there are like, you know, mixed voices on answering that question. So even within the Exodus text itself, I think there's an interesting duality going on for like how much it seems like God is actively pushing for this destruction to happen. So one of the key ways that this text talks about Pharaoh is that his heart was hardened, right? That he turned, like, you know, he became harsher and crueler and more resistant to God's will as the plagues progressed. Now, what's interesting is that in several parts of this narrative, the text says, but the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, and he would not listen to them, just as the Lord had spoken to Moses. So again, like, you know, people would be like, well, I mean, like, if God wants Pharaoh to free Israel, and God can harden Pharaoh's heart, why can't he soften it? Like, isn't that, like, just do that, and then nobody has to do all the other things? Great, very valid question. There is, but then, within the text, too, a second stream where it's talking about, like, but when Pharaoh saw that there was a respite, he hardened his heart and would not listen to them, just as the Lord had said. And then there's another set of, like, you know, characterizations within the text that just talk about Pharaoh's heart being hardened in passive voice, right? So these are just all different ways, even within the text, of being like, all right, what's going on with Pharaoh's heart? Who is the reason here for his horrific brutality against Israel? And I would say from this text alone, I don't think you could probably like sort through how to think about it. Maybe come up with ideas. I think this is one of those things where you kind of got to take a step back and revisit what you think are the, like, you know, multiple things can be true, but I think the question is, what do you think is the truest of all of these stories being told? One of the developments in the arc of the Bible that I appreciate is the, you know, over time, God's people in the scriptures actually come up with language to describe, to like distance God from the like actual evil actions, like actively causing harm on people. So writers they'll kind of, you know, like use other language. They will talk about supernatural forces that can, that can speak to the like supernatural evil forces that could explain what was going on. So, for example, in 2 Samuel, there is a story where the text says, "Is there something?" Are you all right? Sorry, you good? No, all good. So there's a part of the text where it says, again, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he incited David against them, saying, go count the people of Israel and Judah. In this context, doing a census, like counting the people, it's a bad thing. There's a reason within the story that makes sense. And this text is literally saying, incited or tempted is another word that translators use for it, that God tempted or incited David to do this thing that was bad. Now, there's a parallel text in 1 and 2 Chronicles written a long time after this text where the Israelites, they've had time to reflect on this story, and you'll notice a subtle change that they make. Now they say, Satan stood up against Israel and incited David to count the people of Israel. So again, like you people can look at this and be like, oh, that's a contradiction, like in the Bible, like, you know, which of those two things is true, or like neither of those things is true. To me, I see, like, I think this was the right move. This is them having language. They understand God better than they did the first time around, and they have new words to describe what's actually behind the evil forces that happen in the world, and it's not God. I think that is the right step in that direction. This happens in even with the Exodus story itself that we're talking through. So in Exodus, like naturally in this text, it says the Lord struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt. There's a psalm that comes, it's written later, that talks about this exact same thing, but there's a little bit of distance between God. Now it says, God let loose on them a company of destroying angels. Okay, so there are moves like this all the time throughout the text. And I would say, like, when I see these threads occur, to me, one of those perspectives is truer than the other, even if at various times, I don't know, they may all be true in some way. This actually matters. It's very consequential for even the comfort that we offer each other when bad things happen to us in the world. Because if your framework is that perspective where God is the one who gives and takes away, God is the one who's making the good and the bad things happen, then when bad things happen to you or other people, inevitably the type of counseling that you can offer them are things like what? Well, God wanted that to happen. You may not know why now, but someday it will become clear to you. It's like, you know, your baby died because God is teaching you a lesson or something like that. And again, I think you could probably go to other passages or, you know, narratives within the Bible, and you would say like, yeah, I think that's how it works. But I would say that I don't think that's how God works. And I think that the full arc of the story, especially centered around Jesus, actually shows that no, God isn't the one killing babies. There are evil forces in this world, both us and supernatural forces, that are working against God. So this would be like if you were to put this in a table, right? Like chart out what's going on in the plagues, right? So table one, supporters are opponents of a locust swarm. Who is the supporters? Locusts, right? They're, why not? That makes perfect sense for them. Who are the opponents? I think it's critical to put God in the opponents column. God does not want a swarm of locusts to destroy people, anyone. I know, you're like, but that isn't that what literally the Exodus narrative says? Yes, that is what it says, but I think if you have had time to reflect on the entire arc of God's character, especially as revealed in Jesus, then you would actually come to the conclusion that no, God is not actually the force behind a swarm of locusts happening. And then you do what you can to read through the Exodus narrative through that lens. I think a great way, too, that this kind of solidifies in the Apostle Paul's own argument of, like, describing how God's wrath works, comes in his opening to the letter of Romans. So this is when he talks about the, you know, the arc of how Jews and Gentiles together both have been, because of their sinfulness, have experienced God's wrath, and they, you know, both stand in equality, they stand with equality before God. So the way the Apostle Paul starts it, he says, God's wrath is being revealed from heaven against all the ungodly behavior and the injustice of human beings who silence the truth with injustice. Okay, so this opens the question, what does God's wrath look like? How does God execute God's wrath? And this is the repeated refrain that the Apostle Paul gives within this text. He says, God let these people go their own way. So God let them follow their own evil desires. God let their debased minds rule over them. The idea that emerges here is that experiencing God's wrath is a self-inflicted wound. These are things that we put upon ourselves, that we create the hells around us and in us. And it's not God who's doing these things. God does not want to do these things. And this is not even like a super progressive thing to say. There have been many Christian thinkers throughout the centuries who are very well respected among people who are uncomfortable with the Bible speaking with multiple voices or having attention on this type of topic. So C.S. Lewis, for example, has said in his own writings, there are only two kinds of people in the end, those who say to God, thy will be done, and those to whom God says in the end, thy will be done. And he says, in another one of his writings, that the gates of hell are locked from the inside. So this is, again, like you could look at other passages where it seems like God's the one doing the locking of the gates. But hey, you have an opportunity to reflect on many voices within the Bible. And I think it's helpful, too, to hear Jesus and Jesus' followers on where they land. So in 2 Peter, for example, the way this author describes it is the Lord is patient with you, not wanting anyone to perish, but everyone to come to repentance. So that is, like, if you ask me, which voice do I prioritize above all of the others, is that one. That's where I start. I start with from the idea that God has spoken in many ways through many people, but the truest way that God has ever spoken is through Jesus. That's how the Hebrews writer talks about it in their opening letter. So I would say that, like, I'd try it on for size. Like, try that lens as you read through what are going to get even more violent texts throughout the rest of, you know, in the chapters ahead. So another dimension that I think that we can cover now is, you know, so resisting God has a futility to it. Resisting evil, which Moses and the Israelites focus on for the entire text, is also very messy. And I really appreciate the way that Kevin talked about it last week as well, where he described, you know, how injustice is a process. It is a series of decisions that many people make, especially those in power, over a period of time that gets you into this horrible situation that the Israelites find themselves in. And I would say there's a mirror to that too, that justice or doing justice is also a process. It is a series of choices, little ones and big ones, that we all have to make along the way on the long arc of undoing the injustice that exists in the world. And that is going to necessarily be extremely messy and violent. Putting the world right requires breaking the world as it is down. And there's no clean or pure way to do it. And the Exodus narrative does not shy away from that at all. There's, as like Martin Luther King famously said in the letter from Birmingham Jail, right? There's nothing, you know, there's nothing inherent in the flow of time that will cure all ills, right? There's like nothing that's out there that's just going to take care of your problems for you. I would offer that as a critique of like many people's philosophies of karma, just to be like, oh, I know things are bad now, but don't worry. The universe has a way of correcting itself. Like, no, it's not going to correct itself. You're going to have to do something about it, right? And it's from a position of privilege that often that one can offer that kind of comfort to somebody else. I think the hardest part of at its core of like doing like trying to do this work of correcting injustice is like all the how weighty and significant and challenging, like each of those many, like small decisions that we have to make along the way. I think there's an interesting way that this plays out in the series of bargains that Pharaoh has with Moses. So like after a few plagues, after the fourth plague, Pharaoh makes a concession. He says, all right, you can serve your God. You can serve Israel's God, but you've got to do it within Egypt. You got to stay here and do it. And Moses resists. He says, that's just simply not going to work. We cannot, we can't do that and be free. And then after the seventh plague, Pharaoh relents and he says, all right, the men can leave to serve God. They can leave the area. And Moses says, no, it's not just going to be the men. We need everybody along with us. And then after the ninth plague, Pharaoh says, all the people can leave to serve God, but not the animals that belong to them. And Moses' response there, he's cold-blooded. He says, not one hoof shall be left behind. And in these debates, like at each of these stages, Moses could have accepted the terms of the deal. As a male leader among this group, he probably would have experienced those negative consequences the least. But he maintains the mission that he is not there just on his own behalf. He is using his privilege for the sake of all of his people and all of the animals, all the living things under his care. And this is, I think this is actually one of the most fascinating ways that this, exchanges between Pharaoh and Moses develop. It is interesting, too, that, in order to do this well, right, in order to resist evil in a Jesus-centric way, you have to do something that I think is perhaps the hardest thing to do as a Jesus follower who is commanded to love one's neighbor as oneself. And that is you have to want what's best for your enemy. There is, in these debates between Pharaoh and Moses, one of the times when Pharaoh relents, though he only relents temporarily, he asks Moses to pray for him. Pharaoh asks Moses to pray for Pharaoh. And this is the way the text describes what Moses is. So Moses and Aaron went out from Pharaoh, and Moses cried out to the Lord concerning the frogs that he had brought upon Pharaoh. He cried out to the Lord is the way the text describes it. That Hebrew word for cried out is exactly the same one that the text uses just a little bit earlier to describe Israel crying out to God. In other words, this text is saying that Moses is praying for Pharaoh as hard and as earnestly as Israel is praying for their own freedom. I think that is like mind-boggling to think that in that situation, that was his attitude or his response to Pharaoh. Even knowing, like Moses is not an idiot. He knew that there's a really good chance that Pharaoh will back down from this promise that he made, right? As he does repeatedly throughout this cycle. And I think when you get, like when you have that perspective in mind, like, oh, so loving your enemy means wanting what's best for them, then how do you square that with the Miriam's worship song earlier where she was like, oh, I'm so glad that Pharaoh is destroyed? This is interesting. In centuries after Jesus, there is a Jewish rabbinical reflection in the Midrash that actually critiques this perspective of like celebrating that Pharaoh is destroyed. So this the way this Midrash goes is that God saying, my creations, the Egyptians, are drowning in the sea, and you are singing before me? That's a really profound reflection to have on that story. And in a lot of those rabbinical texts, there's a connection to a statement in Proverbs where it says, do not gloat at the fall of your enemy. And again, I think for those of us who are familiar with Jesus' words and Jesus' way of being, this is what it looks like to pray for those who persecute you and bless those who curse you. Now, this is where I would say, like, you know what? You're right. The Bible seems to speak in multiple voices on how to think about one's enemy. But to me, the clearest way that the Bible speaks on this issue is through Jesus' words. And all of the reflections that help us put that as the priority are the right reflections to offer. I think another reason that can be very, very hard in practice to love one's enemy and want what's best for your enemy in the way that Moses does and the way Jesus calls us to do is we are often looking for a level of impact to our, you know, justice-oriented actions that make us have very short tempers or levels of patience for how long it takes for these outcomes to actually happen. We want, often, Joseph-level closure to our stories. So those of us who've been here just very recently, right? Like a couple lessons ago, we were talking about Joseph. And, this is like, what a story, right? So he was, left for dead by his brothers, and he was a slave, and then he had to rise up in Pharaoh's court, and then he was never going to see his dad again, and it was all horrible. And then his brothers, when they're all older, they actually come groveling back to Joseph, and they ask for forgiveness, and Joseph forgives them, and he's able to see his dad again, and they're all able, literally, live happily ever after. That's how the story goes. And Joseph, because of those actions, those things happen to him, he can forgive them, he can experience reconciliation. He says, and now, dude, this is what he tells his brothers when they first come to him asking for forgiveness. Do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. And then later in the Genesis accounts, he says, even though you intended to do harm to me, God intended it for good in order to preserve a numerous people as he is doing today. Oh, beautiful. You get to see all of the return on investment of all of the sacrifices that you made in your lifetime. And, if you're expecting that kind of return on investment, I think you're setting yourself up for great disappointment for what it means to actually have to forgive people in the real world. This is, I think, what's a step in the direction of, like, the types of lack of closure that we often receive in our lifetimes is actually more like how Moses will ultimately experience bringing Israel out of slavery in Egypt, where towards the end of the narrative of Moses' life, there's a reflection in Deuteronomy. It says, then the Lord said to Moses, so he shows Moses the promised land. So Moses is looking out over it. He says, this is the land of which I swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, saying, I will give it to your descendants. I have let you see it with your eyes, but you shall not cross over there. So we'll get to that again, like when we get to the actual text. But Moses and his generation of people who left Israel, they're not the ones who actually get to enter the promised land itself. He never got to see the ultimate good, Moses did. He never got to see the ultimate good that came out of his sacrifices. But he did it anyway. I think this is actually offers a great contrast. So there's a nice bookending to this like part of Exodus that we've covered so far, starting from the midwives at the beginning of the Exodus narratives until now. So remember, we covered this last week. So the midwives, this is the way the text introduces us to them. So this is when they're faced with the edict to kill all of the Israelite baby boys who are born. It says, but the midwives feared God. They did not do as the king of Egypt commanded, but they let the boys live. What's interesting is like towards the end, like once of this like section, when Israel is able to leave Egypt, The text summarizes their exodus like this. It says, Israel saw the great work that the Lord did against the Egyptians, so the people feared the Lord and believed in the Lord's servant Moses. That's the same Hebrew phrase to describe what the midwives did. They feared the Lord. They understood it before the rest of Israel did. But if you looked at those midwives, do you think when they were confronted with the choice of either killing those Israelite baby boys or keeping them alive, were they like, I see that by saying no and resisting Pharaoh, I will eventually topple the entire, you know, kingdom of Egypt, and this is how my people will be free? No, absolutely not. They made that choice because in that moment, it was the right thing to do in and of itself. And it was for other people, for the rest of the Israelites, to experience the domino effects of what it would happen to actually be free. Now they can look back and see how doing right in that case ended up being something that could lead to their freedom. But in that moment, you just do it because it's the right thing to do. I really do think this is like one of the biggest challenges that we face, especially like for those of us who live in the tech world in the Bay Area, where, you know, we think of like all of the things that we consider works of justice or sacrifices that we make, like donating to charity or volunteering our time or protesting policies that we don't like. A lot of the frustration that we experience is because we have a very shallow, simplistic view of the return on investment that we're expecting from that effort that we put in. I think we've been conditioned by work, honestly. Many of us work for shareholders who need that ROI quarter over quarter. And if it's not going to make progress, then we're going to cut it and do something else. And it goes very much against the idea that, you know what, some things are worth doing because they are right doing in and of themselves. That is a very different attitude than what we are taught in the world around us. So you may never hear, I forgive you, for when you say sorry to someone else. You may never get a thank you for the sacrifices that you've made to help other people, maybe even your enemies. You may never hear an authority figure in your life say, I now understand the pain or trauma that my actions caused you. You may never get to hear any of that. You may never get your preferred policies implemented in your country or your state within your lifetime. But that doesn't mean that any of those things are not worth doing. All of them are worth doing in and of themselves because we fear God. We don't fear the emperors around us. And like all God's people before you, you can tell the next generation of God's people about the plagues that you survived and what it took to get them to where they are now. And you can tell them about the plagues that you created for the people around you and how you too need mercy for what you have done. And you can tell them that even though you never got to see the ROI on the works of justice that you did, and maybe even they won't get to see the ROI on the works of justice that they do, it is worth it because your return on investment is with God in heaven, and God is going to redeem, to save, to free all God's children. It is by faith that Spark Church will pursue the Lord, and it is by faith that we resist evil. We now turn to our time together where we reflect on that Passover tradition, where we take our understanding of the way God, through blood and brutality, can make great things, beautiful things, world-changing things happen out of the violence that we put on ourselves. And it is embodied most beautifully in communion as we take it together, carrying on the tradition from Jesus' day, where it says, for in the night in which he was betrayed, our Lord Jesus took the bread, blessed and broke it, giving it to his disciples, saying, take, eat, this is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me. Likewise, after supper, he took the cup, gave thanks, and gave it to them, saying, drink this, all of you. This is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for you and for many for the forgiveness of sins. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me.